My hands are cold, but not as cold as the Mets offense. On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we are going to recap the games two of the ALCS and the NLCS, both of which I, Jake Mintz, was at. But Jordan Schusterman is going to have some insightful thoughts as well. Hello and welcome to the only baseball podcast in the world who knows that maybe OMG stands for, oh, Mets. Gross. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and no number of Pitbull verses could have helped the Mets on Thursday night. No, Wednesday night.
No. Hey, our sense of time is all the way out the window at this point of October as you are recording live from Citi Field, where the Dodgers dispatched of those Mets of Queens rather easily, just as they did in game one. We are going to recap that game three that you just witnessed with your own two eyes and the game two that you also witnessed with your own two eyes between the Yankees and Guardians, as well as previewing the next games up coming up on Thursday. But let's stick with what you just saw, Jake. This will be a quick episode because the last two games we watched were not necessarily as tense. They certainly had their moments, but this one that you just watched was, again, just a version of what we saw in game one, a dominant Dodgers performance. Was Walker Buehler as good as Jack Flaherty? In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. But let's start with Walker Buehler, because I do think that while the Ohtani home run deserves a few minutes on its own, I think Buehler in some ways is the even bigger story from this game three.
So let's set the trajectory, right? Mm-hmm. From 2018 to 2021, through the end of 2021, Walker Buehler had the fourth lowest ERA in baseball, behind only Jacob deGrom, Max Scherzer, and Justin Verlander, a trio of Met legends. He finished fourth in the Cy Young in 2021. He was the Dodgers' game one starter when they won the World Series. He didn't start game one of the World Series because the schedule was pushed off, but he started game one of the first three rounds. Like, that was the guy, right? His elbow explodes. In the middle of 2022, he gets like two other surgeries, I believe, and is a great reminder that the comeback road from Tommy John is not always a linear process. There was a rumor he was going to come back at some point last year. He did not. First start of this season comes in May, and for the first 2 months he's just not very good. Like, his ERA is right under six, and he spends a month away from the team getting his body right at a training facility in Florida, Cressy Sports Performance, and comes back and is a little better, but is not necessarily the Walker Buehler dominant of old. There are flashes in there, but not totally. In his first playoff start, which was game three against the Padres, very bizarre inning in the second inning of that game, during which there's an error and bad defense. He ends up giving up big bomb to Fernando Tatis Jr., allows six runs in that game across five innings, and they lose. Dodgers come back and win the final two against San Diego, setting up this start here for Buehler. Tonight gave him the second most starts in Dodgers franchise postseason history. Now, granted, a lot of that has to do with the expanded postseason field and that they've been in the playoffs every year that Walker Buehler has been on this team. But he is an omnipresent presence for them in this chilly month. And so for him, entering the start, the Dodgers needed a solid performance from him. And that is exactly what he delivered. LA, they go up early in the second inning. Sloppy inning from the Mets. Dodgers score two runs without having a hit that leaves the infield. Francisco Alvarez with a bad decision, throwing a ball to second that he should have thrown to first. You have two balls clanging off of Luis Severino's glove. Dodgers go up too early. Then you have the key moment of the game in the bottom of the second inning, early but important, bases loaded, one out, Alvarez is up, and on the first pitch of that at bat, he swings so hard and so recklessly that the bat goes flying out of his hands and clangs off against the netting. And at that point, you knew he was striking out, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It was like, This is the wrong guy to have up in this spot. Mm-hmm. Lindor comes up, top of the order, two outs, bases loaded. Like, I think it was a 2-2 count. Mm-hmm. And Buehler just rips off a delightful, beautiful knuckle curveball. Lindor swings and misses, and the inning is over the threat is squelched, squashed, quelched. Email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. How many of those are words?
Squelched. I'm going to give that a quick squelched. Google. Squelched? No, I think that's fine. I think somehow all of those sounds which seem like weird onomatopoeias actually all worked. So I think you're in good
shape. Sorry, it was a full count. Against Lindor, not a 2-2 count.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Really just an amazing at-bat. And from there, like, we can kind of fast forward through the rest of this. The Mets work Buehler's pitch count up pretty high, so he only gets through four, but he delivers the most swings and misses he's had in a start since October of 2021. 18 whiffs.
Yeah, 18 whiffs in four innings is also the most that we've seen through four innings in a postseason start since Kyle Loesch. That was one where it was like, that's a great fun fact, but why is it Kyle Loesch? Anyway, that was like 2008. But yeah, he ends the third with a strikeout. He ends the fourth with a strikeout. The pitch count is up there. And Dave Roberts literally said on the broadcast, Kopech's coming in for Lindor. Dave Roberts' honesty dating back to, we met with Ohtani at the winter meetings last year and many other times over the course of this season. And of course his tenure, but I feel like this year in particular is very refreshing. And especially where I hate the in-game manager interviews. That was the first time where I was like, oh, all right. He told me what he's going to do. I appreciate that.
Shouts out to the man now known as D-Gaff Dave.
He's earned it, man. He's earned it. But by the way, I just want to shout out Clinton Yates, who wrote a great piece about Dave Roberts just being underrated and underappreciated. And while we've come on our podcast over the years and been like, what was Dave Roberts thinking? I think he made some extremely good and compelling points in that piece. Anyway, so he only gets through four, but as you said, and as he talked about in his post game, let's just hit on this now because we're not going to talk much about Severino. He was right. And I don't know, from your vantage point, the ball was moving tonight. And Buehler talked repeatedly about how the cold and maybe some of the crosswinds, whatever. Severino's stuff was jumping as well. And I know
slider,
the results, yeah,
he threw to Freddie in the first.
I mean,
looked like a video game.
All of his sweepers but all of Buehler's stuff, the breaking stuff, was just so wicked sharp, and all the metrics were just like a little bit off. And I haven't thought about that specifically, whether it has to do with how cold it is or the winds or whatever, but he was right. Both Severino and Buehler's stuff was moving like just wild.
They have not played a game this cold in this park with these balls and no tack ever. Okay. So all of those elements that matter in terms of ball flight, this is the first time we've seen this concoction. Now, will it continue? Who knows? The winds are weird here. Sure. It's been a very windy few days here in New York City. Like, I don't know if that is notable, but the last thing I'll just say about Buehler, he, after the first batter, moves to the stretch from the windup. And I want to kind of focus in on this. He explained later that it was because the mound was cold and the dirt was hard. And so the way his foot was pushing off of the rubber, it was hard for him to have a feel for that. So he went to the stretch. To have that level of physical athletic intelligence to recognize that adjustment and execute it on the fly is unbelievable. In this spot. Yeah. It's really remarkable stuff.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say about Buehler, and then we kind of zoom to the Ohtani home run and then move on, is the context that you set up was very well done. But I think the other key part here is he's a free agent, right? And I think with what he showed this regular season, you know, maybe with all the injuries that they continue to have, there is a version where he does end up back in LA. But the way that he's been kind of talked about this season is that this probably is it for him there. And his free agency on its own is fascinating. But with that history and how much he has accomplished there, I mean, you mentioned the postseason starts. He was unbelievable in the World Series in 2020 in the game three against Tampa. And he, you know, he's just has a lot of starts. Again, it didn't go as well in 21 for him, and it didn't go as well, back against San Diego. But this was a really, really impressive, as impressive as a four inning performance can really be at this time of year. So I thought that was really cool.
Let's zoom ahead to the top of the sixth. Big drip. Tyler McGill is in the ballgame for the Mets. Tommy Edman single. And then Kike Hernandez, postseason Kike, goes yard, two-run homer, make it 4-0 Dodgers. I believe the 15th playoff homer of his career. And with each homer, someone somewhere forgets to put the accent on the E.
Well, E-Keys, we've been dealing with this in the postseason for a while. But the point is, yeah, I mean, 15 home runs, he basically, his home run frequency essentially doubles when he gets to October relative to the rest of his regular season career. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, there's really nothing more. He did it with Boston, right? He did it with LA for a long time. He did it with Boston in 21. And now he's turned it back on again at a time. And, you know, we have to point out that, like, man, like, he was really bad last season. And really at point this regular season, I thought he was pretty much toast too, but he's still 32 and still obviously, or I guess recently 33. And I still obviously an extremely important part of this team still for a lot of reasons.
4-0 Dodgers. Mets have two runners on, first and second, one out in the sixth. But no, Jose Iglesias. Oh my God. He looks terrible. Has looked really bad recently. It's Pitbull's fault. Don't think about it too hard.
No.
But I just want to finish off with something I will never forget that I regret, which is my head was down. When Shohei Ohtani made contact in the top of the eighth, I was in my seat, but my head was down for that pitch. I heard it because I can hear, and I saw the flight. And I enjoyed that part of it. But as you know, Jordan, part of the downside, again, super not complaining, let me be clear. But for our job, we're writing every night during these games. And so you're like watching some ball and then you're typing and then you're watching some ball and then you're typing. And I just happened to have my head down writing my story when Shohei melted one.
Like, especially over in a game there. Like this. Yeah. Yeah. And I know, right, and you'd missed the, I think it was the Soto home run. You were in the bathroom, right? I don't remember which one.
Yes, the Soto home run I missed I was aware, awake, alert, and enthusiastic for Aaron Judge's bomb last night.
We'll get to that. We're going to get to that later. But the point is, again, appreciate the honesty. And to your point, further in defense of your actions there with the head down, again, at this point,
No defense. Shohei Ohtani's up. I got to be
true.
Locked in.
That's true. It doesn't matter if the Dodgers are up by 50 and you want to get ahead and start your story. That's true. I think that's a lesson learned for you who, I guess this was the first Ohtani game that you have seen in person since when?
No, I've seen the Dodgers four times this year.
Okay. Four different series. This postseason. Yeah. Okay. I'm just trying to think. Right. And I both saw the Dodgers a couple times.
I saw him in, I saw him at Yankee Stadium. I saw him here earlier in the year. I saw him in Philly and I saw them in DC. And everything Ohtani does is news. Yeah. And
that's the one at bat you gotta be paying attention to. And especially when there were runners on base.
Correct. Go ahead.
Because the funniest trend of Ohtani so far this postseason, I don't have the exact, he's like 0 for 20 something, I think, with the bases empty and 7 for 8. Which, by the way, if you stretch back to the regular season, I think it's now 17 for his last 20 with runners in scoring position, which is just laughable.
Let me just say this. Is that weird? Yeah. Is it concerning that he's bad with no one on? No, not really.
Hey, Is it not? Is it not better this way?
Yeah, I was literally going to say, like, way better than the other way around. Okay. Like, yeah. Oh no, he's only driving in runs.
Yeah, exactly. 7 for 9 this postseason. Thank you, producer Andrew Hartz. 0 for 22 with the bases empty. Like, one of the great small sample size things we've seen. But again, this was kind of the case in the regular season in September as well. So, but let's just zoom in on this home run specifically, even though you didn't see it. I guess the first instinct is it fair? I mean, it was almost over the foul pole, at least on TV. But I don't know what your vantage point was, at least. Like, I know you missed it live, but...
No, I saw the ball flight. Ohtani home runs.
Just didn't see the connection, right?
Ohtani home runs stay fair because they're hit so hard.
Yes.
So the ball just simply has less time to curl to the right side of the right field foul pole. And so you kind of knew it was gone. Ohtani points at his dugout. I would have asked him who he was pointing at, but he didn't do the press conference today. So I want to know, was it someone specific? Was he pointing at Michael Kopech? Like, that's for you. Was it more of like, that's for you, the team, that's for you, the fans? I want these answers. But Ohtani home run postseason, can't take it for granted. I'll can't wait to tell my grandkids that I missed it. Max Muncy in the eighth, homers to make it 8-0.
Yeah.
By that point, there's no one here. Like,
no,
the fans were gone.
Yeah.
And the Dodgers.
A tribute to the Dodgers fans who did the same thing in game one.
I mean,
it's just a fact. I understand that traffic was not fun probably for any of the fans involved, but that was also true in Dodger Stadium when they were winning. Anyway, let's just hit on Max Muncy here, which is important. He reached base all five times. He has reached base now, I think, his last eight times to the plate. And my main... this is, again, jumping ahead to our next segment. What the Guardians would give to have Max Muncy. I mean, and this dude, I know he was batting fourth tonight, but he's the part of this lineup where it's like, oh my gosh, you have to deal with it. And I would say also, he is, though, especially important because my goodness is Freddie Freeman injured. I mean, this poor guy is grinding through this and still putting together some good at-bats, but he is a singles-only hitter. Like, he is up there to work the count and then hopefully plop a single and then hope that someone hits a home run behind him, because we are not watching anywhere close to the best version of Freddie Freeman. And so Max Muncy, the best version of Max Muncy, is kind of helping fill that quote-unquote gap.
Kirk Gibson is watching Max Muncy and is like, that guy looks like he's in pain. Like, it's not good. Or sorry, not Max Muncy, Freddie Freeman. He's like, that guy is not having a good time.
But Muncy looks unbelievable. And he's just, you know, one of the other, you know, just luxuries of this Dodgers lineup.
All right. So game four tomorrow, Jose Quintana, who has been the best pitcher on planet Earth over the last 2 months. Yeah. Only kind of kidding. Not really. He's going up against Yoshinobu Yamamoto. That's going to be a hilarious juxtaposition between two pitchers. Very excited to watch that one. What are we looking for now? I'll kick it to you. You give me one thing. And I'll give you one thing.
I'll just say, well, one, I mean, if we do have the same conditions, I mean, what's that Yamamoto splitter looking like tomorrow, right? I mean, what is Yamamoto's stuff after how good he looked in game five? How deep can he go into this game? Obviously, with the lead they ended up building, you know, they did use Kopech and they did use Trinan, but they were able to stay away from Hudson, stay away from Phillips. So they'll have some other options still in this next game for the Dodgers. And then, yeah, I mean, can Quintana, as a lefty, right? I mean, with how the success that Minaya had, can Quintana kind of replicate that? He's not as funky as Minaya is, so it's possible that his stuff just isn't good enough and the Dodgers hit a bunch of homers, but I think that the matchup there is still probably a little bit better.
I am genuinely just excited to watch Shohei play another postseason game in person. I have a feeling, Jordan Schusterman, that you will have that experience at some point soon. And I just,
we'll see. Mm-hmm.
It's one of those moments where you just feel so lucky. Like, you just feel so lucky that I get to see this and witness this and watch this and enjoy this and analyze this and think about this and have it be my life for a time and a moment in it. And I feel very humbled by that. Yeah, and so I can't wait to watch Ohtani again tomorrow. All right. I'm cold. My hands are chilly. So let's take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll talk about a similarly frigid American League Championship Series. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schuster. The New York Yankees are up 2-0 in the ALCS. I was in the Bronx last night for game two. And I put this in my story yesterday, but these are my thoughts about game two. The Yankees left the door open. The Guardians, instead of running through it, went headfirst into the door frame and fell backwards onto the ground. Neither of these teams played particularly crisp baseball last night. I give the Yankees a B-, and I would give the Guardians a D, a straight D.
Yeah. I mean, maybe a D+, because you finally got a Jose Ramirez home run. I know, he had one against Detroit, but and they were in this game, but I think it had more. That's why I think I would be more harsh about the Yankees. We don't really have to go beat by beat in this one. I mean, Gerrit Cole was, I mean, that's about as bad as you'll see his command in general, but the stuff is still Gerrit Cole. He was breaking out a sinker that we haven't really seen from him at all this season. That was ridiculous. That reminded me of Pittsburgh Gerrit Cole. Like, I was like, you remember when we saw that in San Francisco, one of our trips a lot, 2015, we saw the Pirates in San Francisco and we were sitting in the amazing press box, San Francisco, which is very low. And so it's one of the best views you can kind of get of a pitcher in a big league press box. And Gerrit Cole was incredible in that game. And it was when he was throwing those sinkers. It was only throwing, he's like, this is before he goes to Houston and is doing the four seam. And that's what it looked like. I didn't throw that many of them, but he was breaking that out. But the command was just not there. And Cleveland just kind of let him off the hook in the early innings. And then he kind of lost it and did have an early exit. But honestly, you think about it, it was ace versus ace. Bibee gets four outs and Cole gets through into the fifth. Yep. And that was a huge difference.
Look, on the last podcast, we had a slight disagreement about Tanner Bibee and Gerrit Cole. And I'm not here to, like, I'm not, I understand what your point was, that Tanner Bibee is better than people think. Mm. And I understand that one bad start does not get rid of that, right? Mm. However, the Guardians' best pitcher was going up against maybe the best pitcher. And the gap we saw on off nights for both of them exemplifies the chasm between Cole and most other people, right? Most other pitchers. He did not have it. Like, he really did not have it, and it didn't matter because the Guardians couldn't take advantage. So the Yankees score on like an early error. There's a double. Bibee's out after four outs. Gardo's go right to the bullpen. There's a key moment. I think it was in the third inning where the bases are loaded with one out and Bo Naylor is up. And he's not a good hitter. And so Stephen Vogt, Gardo's manager, in the fourth inning, Gardo's manager
loaded one out,
goes to David Fry to pinch hit. David Fry was on the bench because he's a righty, but he's easily the best hitter on the bench. And even though Naylor's a lefty, Fry is the right move in that spot. It's a good process. Bad process is Fry swinging at the first pitch, fastball up and in under his hands in the strike zone, but not a good pitch to swing at on a 0-0 count when the hitter before you was walked on four pitches to load the bases. That was the death knell. And even though the Gardo was like clawed back a little bit, that was the moment where I kind of felt like it was gone. Yankees end up having some base running mistakes. Clay Holmes comes in. He gives up one run after Cole gets into some trouble in the fifth inning. And I'll just zoom ahead to Aaron Judge. Aaron Judge hits a home run in October. Mm-hmm. Cool. Pretty sweet.
It was pretty sweet. It was, again, not a pitch. It was a strike because he's gigantic, but not a normal pitch to hit out. Stephen Vogt said today when he was asked about it, oh, you know, what do you feel when Judge is stepping in? He's like, listen, man, I like watching him hit too. He's pretty good. I am a baseball fan. It's like, yeah, but it's easy for him to say that now. And in that spot, I mean, again, Gattis, which wasn't a bad pitch, but Judge, he's capable of doing that. It is, as Boone has said, it's only a matter of time. And then that's what that was.
And we should mention earlier in this game, Juan Soto was walked intentionally so that the Guardians could bring in Cade Smith to face Judge. Now, it's a weird headline. Walk is going to face Aaron Judge. You called me yesterday and made a great point. It's Juan Soto. Like, that's the point of having these two guys on the same team, is that you have to face one of them. It is not as if he walked you to face Aaron Judge.
Literally almost any other hitter in the league, right? The number of players you would be considering this with. Like, that's the story. It's that they're on the same team. That's been the story the whole time. And so omitting that obvious reality when discussing that decision, which was still an interesting managerial decision, right?
The correct one.
Probably, yeah. And it did. That was not the problem, right? He does get, you know, Judge to fly out for a sac fly, which some other pitchers, maybe Bibee does allow a double or a homer, right? You know, are you better off bringing Cade Smith and just having him face Soto? There's conversations there to be had. But again, just being like, oh my God, why would you walk the bases loaded for a vote crazy? It's like, okay, but why, think for one more second why he would even begin to be doing that. It's because Juan Soto is the guy hitting before him.
And Judge was asked about that in the post game, and he said They did it to him earlier this year. I wasn't too surprised, which is another way of saying it's Juan Soto.
Yes. Yes.
Right. It's Juan Soto. If it was, with all due respect, any other Yankee, it would be wild. But it wasn't. It was Judge. So yeah, Judge hits that postseason home run. We talked about his postseason slump or underperformance or whatever. And I poo-pooed it as a narrative because that's like, he's so good and it's a small sample size. And Aaron Judge's faith in himself is outrageous. And Aaron Boone's faith in Aaron Judge is outrageous. And like, this was going to happen eventually. And like, Yankees fans should be thrilled that they're up two games. They should be concerned about how the team has played. Aaron Judge should not be their concern.
No. And by the way, I would apply the same thing to like even the Cleveland discussion is like, oh, is Jose Ramirez doing enough? I mean, my God, he looked great.
His at-bats are amazing.
He's the least of my concerns about Cleveland's offense. And that's as we spin this forward to game three. Of course, I'll be there tomorrow. I mean, the thing about this is just the Cleveland's chance here. We're going to have Clark Schmidt against Matthew Boyd. Boyd's certainly throwing the ball well, and I assume they're going to want to get more than 4 outs from him there. And Schmidt's been solid, right? But we'll see what they can get out of him. Cleveland's chance here in this series is to force the Yankees to move to have to use more than the three main relievers that they've basically just used in every single game, and end up in a situation where you have them bringing in a Hamilton or a Cousins or a Stroman, and then with 3 games in 3 days, you're forcing Boone to make some tough decisions, or you're forcing your A relievers to face the same guys again and again, right? Ramirez hitting that home run off Weaver. Can you get more at-bats against him where you're liking that matchup? Still, though, there's just so many more opportunities for Yankees hitters. You got Rizzo hitting eighth. I know he was hurt. I know he's had a bad season. It's still Anthony Rizzo. You're still taking that guy to deliver a big hit over almost anybody in the Guardians lineup, and that's the luxury they have. Again, it's just not the personnel difference. It's just so drastic. And it doesn't mean Cleveland is doomed. It just means that they have to play way better. Like they need to play their A game, and the Yankees can win with their C-plus game. And that's really what we've seen so far.
I am very disappointed in the Guardians because this is not the baseball they've been playing all year.
Yeah.
And if they had played that style, that brand, that quality of ball, they would have won one of these two games. We would have had a series here.
For sure.
And that is what I, as a neutral who follows and analyzes this, want. Like, if you're a Yankees fan, you should be stoked and happy as if you were up 2-0 on 2 15-0 games, right? Because a win's a win in October. Aaron Boone said that after the game. But like, as someone who doesn't particularly care emotionally whether one team wins or the other, I just want to watch something entertaining. And game two was entertaining in a way, but in a way that like bad reality TV is entertaining, and not in a way that you know, Peaky Blinders or you know, The Wire is thrilling. Yes. And so for me, that is what I hope for. Yes. Last thing I want to say, we got a great email from a listener named Paul, and he is a long email. I just want to read a paragraph of it about the Guardians. It is telling regarding the state of baseball that you need to come up with another name in addition to Johnny Holstaff. I particularly like your idea of Andy All Hands on Dekowitz, but my mind immediately went to Bob All the Fellers. Guardians.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell multiple people who work for that team about Bob All the Fellers, Paul, and I will give you credit. And we'll see if that catches on, because it is so good. And if Matt Boyd only goes 3, possible.
Yeah. They used the 8 pitchers.
Bob. It'll be Bob again.
They used 8 pitchers in a game started by Bivey, which was obviously not the plan. But
that was
see.
Tanner too many of the Fellers.
Yes, way too many. That was not plan A. But we will see if Cleveland can get their way back into this one. I'm excited for Thursday night.
If the series goes back to New York, you will be there.
I think I will be there, yeah.
Will you be there?
I don't think this is going to be a sweep, but This is gonna be tough. I'm not feeling as good about my Yankees in seven. I think on the site I said Yankees in six, and I think I said on here Yankees in seven, but I don't know. I'll be seeing you next week at some point.
That's so true.
I'm looking forward to that.
You remember the other episode where I said Mets in four like 100 times after they lost game one? My mom called me and was like, "Were you confused?" I was like, "No, Mom, it was a joke." Let's take a quick break, and when we get back on Baseball Barbercast, we will talk about a very notable, bizarre story that we can't really digest right now, and then say goodbye. Bye. All right, welcome back. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Just a couple quick notes before we talk about the Tampa Bay Rays and how they don't have a stadium. Phillies manager Rob Thompson extended, I believe, through the end of the 2026 season. That entire coaching staff is hanging around. Even though the Phillies crashed out in embarrassing fashion, I actually think that's probably the right move to keep all those people. I think it's more of a personnel mix on the field in terms of getting more hitters with more contact than it is the voices coming from within. Fine with me. We got a report that Jerry Reinsdorf is open to selling the White Sox. That's from Britt Jaroli over at The Athletic. I think I also heard that the White Sox are open to selling Jerry Reinsdorf.
Yeah, well, this is, again, anything involving ownership changes, and also some more convincing reports that the Twins ownership, the Polads, are considering selling. I know their track record is a little bit more positive recently than the Reinsdorf, certainly comparatively, but I know there was some optimism reaction. I know Aaron Gleeman wrote a really interesting, I always trust his Twins opinions. So any sort of ownership, you know, decisions here are a big deal. And so if we get more teams selling, that is a big deal in baseball.
You should buy the Twins, I'll buy the White Sox, and then we can hang out all the time whenever they play.
I'm in Cleveland.
Where you live. White Sox fans open to, what does it say, throwing Jerry Reinsdorf into the Hague.
No, come on. They would just be like, just move along, Jerry. We'll take it from here. The last bit of news, which is just kind of hard to process, and we say this about any non-postseason related news during the postseason, but of course we talked about after the hurricane what happened to the Tropicana Field roof, which is that it's not there anymore, is
the roof is on the ground, which is not what roofs are supposed to do.
And like now, I think there was the initial shock, you know, factor of that. And then you realize the reporting around this is extremely unlikely to be ready for opening day, which on one hand is like, duh. On the other hand is like, that's 4 months, 5 months from now. Like, that kind of speaks to how, I mean, you look at it and you understand it's a big deal, but then you really start to grapple with just like what it's going to take to get this stadium back in workable, playable condition. And then you just think about the ramifications for that. I mean, we're already going into a season where we have no clue or trust in what is going to happen with the Oakland A's home games. And now we're dealing with a situation in Tampa where we thought we were heading towards a resolution, right? They have this new stadium that they're planning to build, and it's all looking good, you know, for a few years from now, and then this was going to be the end of the Trop, and now it's just so many logistical issues with this. So is this going to be one of the biggest stories of the offseason by far?
And some good reporting from Sam Blum over at The Athletic about how the material on the roof was like outdated and expired, and it seems like the Rays were trying to like just
trying to get there, just trying to get to 28. Yeah.
And it just didn't happen. Yeah. Another element here is, correct me if I'm wrong, the Rays play a lot of their spring training games in the Trop. And so I imagine their spring training complex is like their stadium is maybe a little bit less equipped to be a home stadium.
I mean, there's a lot of issues with the alternatives. Okay, great. You go play at a spring training complex, you're just going to have rain out after rain out after rain out. There's a reason they're playing indoors in Florida. But again, there's going to be a lot of discussion about what the alternatives are.
As far as a facility that could do it, like the Tampa Yankees stadium is huge, relatively.
How weird would that be?
That would be weird. And obviously, the Tampa Yankees, are they the Tarpons? I guess they're the Tarpons now. Yeah. They would have to play somewhere, but this will be a big deal as soon as the final out of the World Series is tallied.
Yeah,
and we can turn our
let alone like if the Rays were in the postseason as they normally are, right? I mean, that's just an alternative timeline, but
yeah. But anyway. Jordan, the wild card round is over.
Yeah, that's true. We are past that. Come on, we don't need to be mean to the Rays right now. Anyway, so that's a big story that we felt like we should acknowledge. That's it. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for staying up late, making this possible. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for doing this from Citi Field. We will be at these games tomorrow night. Our next podcast will likely be on Friday, but be patient with us as we kind of navigate this chaotic schedule. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. We appreciate the support and the listening. And yeah, we will talk to you all again very soon. Bye-bye.